beauty made a pain in her heart. He said, "I had forgotten you were a priestess, and you believe." Their hands were clasped lightly. She felt his stir within her own and loosed it. "Sometimes I do not know what I believe. Perhaps I've been too long away from Avalon."
"Nor do I know what I believe," he said.
"But I've seen so many men die, and women, little children, in this long, long war. It seems that I've been fighting since I grew tall enough to hold a sword. And when I see them die, I think faith is an illusion. And the truth is that we all die as the beasts die, and are no more, ever. Like grass cut down and last year's snow. But these things too return again," Morgaine whispered.
"Do they? Or is this the illusion?"
His voice sounded bitter.
"I think perhaps there is no meaning in any of it. All the talk of gods and the goddesses are fables to comfort children." "Oh, God, Morgaine, why are we talking like this? You should go to your rest, cousin, and so should I."
"I will go if you wish it," she said. And even as she turned away, happiness surged through her because he reached for her hand.
"No, no. When I'm alone, I fall prey to these fancies and wretched doubts. And if they must come, I would rather speak them aloud so I can hear what folly they are. Stay with me, Morgaine."
"As long as you wish," she whispered, and felt tears in her eyes. She reached out and put her arms around his waist. His strong arms tightened about her, then loosened remorsefully.
"You are so little. I'd forgotten how little you are. I could break you with my two hands, cousin."
His hands strayed to her hair, which she had bundled loose under her veil. He stroked it, twined an end of it around his fingers.
"Morgaine, Morgaine. Sometimes it seems to me that you are one of the few things in my life which is all good. Like one of those old fairy folk they tell of in legends, the elf woman who comes from the unknown land to speak words of beauty and hope to a mortal, then departs again for the islands of the west, and is never seen again."
"But I will not depart," she whispered.
"No."
At one side of the flagged yard there was a block where sometimes men sat waiting for their horses. He drew her toward it and said,
"Sit here beside me."
Then hesitated.
"No, this is no place for a lady."
And started to laugh.
"Nor was the stable that day. Do you remember, Morgaine?"
"I thought you had forgotten after that devil horse threw you."
"You shouldn't call him devil. He saved Arthur's life in battle more than once, and Arthur would think him guardian angel instead,"
Lancelot said.
"Oh, that was a day of wretchedness. I would have wronged you, cousin, to take you like that.
I've often longed to beg your pardon, and here you grant me forgiveness, and say you bore me no malice."
"Malice?"
She looked up at him, and felt suddenly dizzied by the rush of intense emotion. "Malice? Only, perhaps, to those who interrupted us."
"Is it so?"
His voice was soft. He took her face between his hands and bent, deliberately, laying his lips against hers. Morgaine let herself go soft against him, opening her mouth beneath his lips. He was clean-shaven in the Roman fashion, and she felt the prickly softness of his face against her cheek, the warm sweetness of his tongue probing her mouth. He drew her closer, almost lifting her from her feet, making a soft, murmuring sound. The kiss went on until she finally, reluctantly, had to move her mouth to breathe. And he laughed softly, a sound of wonder.
"So, here we are again. It seems we have been here before, and this time I will cut off the head of any that interrupts us. But we stand here kissing in the stable yard like serving man and kitchen wench. What now, Morgaine? Where do we go?
She didn't know. There wasn't any place, it seemed, secure for them. She couldn't take him to her room where she slept with Elaine and four of Guinevere's maidens, and Lancelot himself had said he preferred to sleep among the soldiers. And something at the back of her mind told her that this was not the way. The king's sister and the king's friend should not go seeking a hayloft. The proper way, if truly they felt this about each other, was to wait until dawn and ask Arthur's permission to marry. Yet in her heart, hidden away so that she need not look at it, she knew that this was not what Lancelot wanted. In a moment of passion he might desire her indeed, but no more. And for a moment of passion would she entrap him into a lifelong pledge. The way of the tribal festivals was more honest. Man and woman should come together with the sun tides and the moon tides in their blood, as the goddess willed, and only if they wished, later, to share a home and rear children, was marriage thought upon. She knew in her heart, too, that she had no real wish to marry Lancelot, or any other, even though she felt, for his own sake, and for Arthur's, and even for Guinevere's, it would be best to remove him from the court. But that was a fleeting thought. She was dizzy with his closeness, the sound of his heart pounding against her cheek. He wanted her. There was not, now, in his heart, any thought of Guinevere or anyone but herself. Let it be with us as the goddess wills, man and woman. I know, she whispered, and caught at his hand. Around, behind the stables and the forge, there was a path leading to the orchard. The grass was thick and soft, and sometimes the women sat there on a bright afternoon. Lancelot spread his cloak in the grass. Around them was the indefinable scent of green apples and grass, and Morgaine thought, almost we might be in Avalon. With that trick he had of catching up her thoughts, he murmured, "We have found ourselves a corner of Avalon this night," and drew her down beside him. He took off her veil, stroking her hair, but he seemed in no haste for more, holding her gently, now and again leaning down to kiss her on cheek or forehead. "The grass is dry. No dew has fallen. Like enough there will be rain before morning," he murmured, caressing her shoulder and her small hands. She felt his hand, sword-calloused and hard, so hard that it startled her to remember he was full 4 years younger than she was herself. She had heard the story. He had been born when Vivian thought herself well beyond childbearing. His long fingers could encircle her whole hand and conceal it there. He toyed with her fingers, playing with her rings, moving his hand to the breast of her gown, and unlacing it there. She felt dizzied, shaken, passion sweeping through her like the tide surging in and covering a beach, so that she went under and drowned in his kisses. He murmured something that she couldn't hear, but she didn't ask what he had said. She was beyond listening to words. He had to help her out of her gown. The dresses worn at court were more elaborate than the simple robe she had worn as a priestess, and she felt clumsy, awkward. Would he like her? Her breasts seemed so soft and limp. They had been so since Gwydion's birth. She remembered how they had been when he first touched her, tiny and hard. But he seemed to notice nothing, fondling her breasts, taking the nipples between his fingers, and then, gently, between his lips and his teeth. Then she lost thought altogether, nothing existing in the world for her except his hands touching her, the pulse of awareness in her own fingers, running down the smoothness of his shoulders, his back, the fine dark softness of the hair there. Somehow she had thought that the hair on a man's chest would be wiry and coarse, but it was not so with him. It was soft and silky as her own hair, curling so fine and close. In a daze, she remembered that the first time for her had been with a youth no more than 17, who scarce knew what he was about, so that she had had to guide him, to show him what to do. And for her, that had been the only time. So that she came almost virgin to Lancelot. In a rush of grief, she wished that for her it was the first time, so that it might have been so blissful for her to remember. It should have been like this. This was how it should have been. She moved her body against his, clinging in entreaty, moaning. She couldn't bear now to wait any longer. It seemed he was not yet ready, though she was all alive to him, her body flowing with the pulse of life and desire in her. She moved against him, hungry, her mouth avid, entreating. She whispered his name, begging now, almost afraid. He went on kissing her gently, his hands moving to stroke and soothe her. But she didn't want to be soothed now. Her body was crying out for completion. It was starvation, agony. She tried to speak, to beg him, but it came out a sobbing whimper. He held her gently against him, still stroking her.
Hush. No, hush, Morgaine. Wait. No more now. I do not want to hurt or dishonour you. Never think that.
Here. Lie here by me. Let me hold you. I will content you. And in despair and confusion she let him do what he would. But even while her body cried out for the pleasure he gave her, a curious anger was growing. What of the flow of life between their two bodies, male and female, the tides of the goddess rising and compelling them? Somehow it seemed to her that he was stemming that tide, that he was making her love for him a mockery and a game, a pretense. And he didn't seem to mind. It seemed to him that this was the way it should be, so that they were both pleasured, as if nothing mattered but their bodies, that there was no greater joining with all of life. To the priestess, reared in Avalon, and attuned to the greater tides of life and eternity, this careful, sensuous, deliberate love-making seemed almost blasphemy, a refusal to give themselves up to the will of the goddess. And then, in the depths of mingled pleasure and humiliation, she began to excuse him. He hadn't been reared as she was in Avalon, but thrown about from fosterage to court to military camp. He had been a soldier almost as long as he had been old enough to lift a sword. His life had been spent in the field. Perhaps he didn't know. Or perhaps he was accustomed only to such women as would give him no more than a moment's ease for his body. Or such women as wanted to toy with love-making and give nothing. He had said, "I do not want to hurt or dishonour you." As if he truly believed there could be something wrong or dishonourable in this coming together. Spent now, he was turned a little away from her. But he was still touching her, toying with her, drawing his fingers through the fine hair at her thighs, kissing her neck and breasts. She closed her eyes, holding herself to him, angry and desolate. Well, perhaps it was no more than she deserved. She had played the harlot in coming to him like this. Perhaps it was no more than her due that he should treat her as one. And she was so besotted that she had let him take her like this. She would have let him do whatever he would, knowing that if she asked for more, she would lose even this. And she longed for him. She still hungered for him, with an intolerable ache that would never be wholly slaked. And he wanted her not at all.
Still in his heart he hungered for Guinevere, or for some woman he could have without giving more of himself than this empty touching of skins. A woman who could be content to give herself and ask nothing more of him than pleasure. Through the ache and hunger of her love, a faint strain of contempt was threading, and it was the greatest agony of all, that she loved him no less, that she knew she would love him always, no less than at this moment of hunger and despair. She sat up, drawing her gown toward her, fastening it over her shoulders with shaking fingers. He sat silent, watching her, stretching out his hands to help her adjust it. After a long time, he said sorrowfully, "We have done wrong, my Morgaine, you and I. Are you angry with me?" She couldn't speak. Her voice was too tight with pain. At last she said, straining her voice to form the words, "No, not angry." And she knew that she should raise her voice and scream at him, demand what he could not give her. Nor any woman, perhaps. "You are my cousin, my kinswoman. But there is no harm done," he said, and his voice was shaking. "At least I have not that to blame myself, that I could bring you to dishonour before all the court. I would not do so for the world. Believe me, cousin, I love you well." She could not keep back her sobs now. "Lancelot, I beg you, in the name of the goddess, speak not so. What harm is done? It was in the way of the goddess, what we both desired." He made a gesture of distress. "You speak so of the goddess and such heathen things. Almost you frighten me, kinswoman, when I would keep myself from sin. And yet I have looked on you with lust and wickedness, knowing it was wrong." He drew on his clothes with trembling hands. At last he said, almost choking, "The sin seems to me more deadly, I suppose, than it is. I would you were not so like to my mother, Morgaine." It was like a blow in the face, like a cruel and treacherous blow. For a moment she couldn't speak. Then, for an instant, it seemed that the full rage of the goddess angered, possessed her, and she felt herself rising, towering. She knew it was the glamour of the goddess coming upon her, as it had done in the Avalon barge. She felt herself small and insignificant as she was, looming over him, and saw the powerful knight, the captain of the king's horse, shrink away, small and frightened, as all men are small in the sight of the goddess. You are a contemptible fool, Lancelot," she said. "You are not even worth cursing." She turned and fled from him, leaving him sitting there with his breeches half fastened, staring after her in astonishment and shame. She felt her heart pounding. Half of her had wanted to scream at him, shrewish as a skua gull. The other half wanted to break down and weep in agony, in despair, begging for the deeper love he had denied her and rejected, refusing the goddess in her. Fragments of thought flickered in her mind, an old tale of the goddess, surprised and refused by a man, and how the goddess had had him torn to shreds by the hounds who ran hunting with her. And there was sorrow that she had what she had dreamed of all these long years, and it was dust and ashes to her. "A priest would say this was the wages of sin. I heard such, often enough, from Ygraine's house priest before I went to be fostered in Avalon. At heart, am I more of a Christian than I know?" And again, it seemed to her that her heart must break from the wreck and disaster of her love. In Avalon, this could never have come to pass. Those who came to the goddess in this way would never have so refused her power.
She paced up and down, a raging fire unslaked in her veins, knowing that no one could possibly understand how she felt, except for another priestess of the goddess. Vivian, she thought with longing. Vivian would understand. Or Raven. Or any of us reared in the House of Maidens. What have I been doing all these long years away from my goddess? Morgaine speaks. 3 days later, I got leave from Arthur to depart from his court and ride to Avalon. I said only that I was homesick for the Isle and for Vivian, my foster mother. And in those days I had no speech with Lancelot, save for the small courtesies of every day when we could not avoid meeting. Even in those I marked that he would not meet my eyes, and I felt angry and shamed, and went out of my way that I might not come face to face with him at all. So I took horse, and rode eastward through the hills. Nor did I return to Caerleon for many years, nor knew I anything of what befell in Arthur's court. But that is a tale for another time. Chapter 8 In the summer of the next year, the Saxons were massing off the coast, and Arthur and his men spent all the year in gathering an army for the battle they knew must come. Arthur led his men into battle and drove the Saxons back. But it wasn't the decisive battle and victory for which he had hoped. They were damaged indeed, and it would take them more than a year to recover. But he hadn't enough horses and men to defeat them firmly and for all time, as he hoped to do. At this battle he took a wound, which seemed not serious, but it festered and inflamed, and he had to spend much of the autumn bedfast. The first snow flurries were coming over the walls of Caerleon before he could walk a little about the courtyard, leaning on a stick, and he would bear the scars to his grave.
"It will be full spring before I can sit a horse again," he observed gloomily to Guinevere, who stood close to the courtyard wall, her blue cloak wrapped tight around her. "It may well be," Lancelot said, "and longer, my dear lord, if you take cold in your wound before it is full healed. Come within doors, I beg you. Look, there is snow on Guinevere's cloak. And in your beard, Lance. Or is that only the first grey?" Arthur asked, teasing, and Lancelot laughed. "Both, I suppose. There you have the advantage of me, my king. Your beard is so fair the grey will not show when it comes. Here, lean on my arm."
Arthur would have waved him away, but Guinevere said, "No, take his arm, Arthur. You will undo all our fine leechcraft if you fall, and the stones are slippery underfoot with this snow melting as it comes down." Arthur sighed and leaned on his friend's arm.
"Now have I a taste of what it must be like to be old."
Guinevere came and took his other arm, and he laughed.
"Will you love me and uphold me like this when indeed there is grey in my beard and hair, and when I go on a stick like the Merlin?"
"Even when you are 90, my lord," said Lancelot, laughing with him.
"I can see it well. Guinevere holding you by one arm, and I by the other, as our ancient steps totter toward your throne. We will all be 90 or thereabout."
Abruptly he sobered.
"I'm troubled about Taliesin, my lord. He grows feeble, and his eyes are failing. Should he not go back to Avalon and rest his last years in peace?" "No doubt he should," said Arthur. "But he says he will not leave me alone with only the priests for counsellors."
"What better counsellors than the priests could you have, my lord?" Guinevere flared. She resented the unearthly word Avalon. It frightened her to think that Arthur was sworn to protect their heathenish ways. They came into the hall, where a fire was burning, and Arthur made a gesture of annoyance as Lancelot eased him into his chair.
"Aye,
set the old man by the fire and give him his posset. I marvel that you let me wear shoes and hose instead of a bedgown.
My dear lord, Guinevere began, but Lancelot laid a hand on her shoulder.
Don't fret yourself, kinswoman. All men are so, peevish when they are ill. He knows not when he is well off, being nursed by fair women, and tended with dainty foods and clean linen, and those possets he scorns. I have lain with a wound in a field camp, nursed by a sour old man too lame to fight, and lying in my own shit because I couldn't shift myself. And no one came near to help me, with nothing brought but some sour beer and hard bread to soak in it. Stop grumbling, Arthur, or I shall try to see to it that you nurse your wound in manly fashion as befits a true soldier.
Aye, and he would do it too,
said Arthur, with an affectionate smile at his friend.
You go not in much fear of your king, Prince Galahad.
He took the horn spoon from his wife's hand, and began to eat the concoction of warmed wine with bread and honey soaked in it.
Aye, this is good and warming. It has spices in it, has it not? Those same spices you bade me send for from Londinium.
Kai came to them when Arthur had finished, and said,
So, how goes the wound after an hour of walking on it, my lord? Is there still much pain?
Not as much as the last time, and that's all I can say, Arthur said. It's the first time I have known what real fear was. Fear I might die with my work still undone.
God would not have it so, Guinevere said.
Arthur patted her hand.
I told myself that, but a voice within kept saying to me that this was the great sin of pride, fearing that I or any man couldn't be spared from what God wishes to be done. I have thought long about such things while I lay unable to set foot to the ground.
I cannot see that you have so much undone, save for the final victory over the Saxons, my lord,
said Kai.
But now you must go to your bed. You are weary with the out-of-doors.
When Arthur was stretched out on the bed, Kai took his clothes away and examined the great wound which still, faintly, oozed matter through the cloths. Kai said,
I will send for the women, and you must have hot cloths on this again. You have strained it. It's well you didn't break it open while you were walking.
When the women had brought steaming kettles and mixed the compresses of herbs and hot water, laying folded cloths upon the wound so hot that Arthur winced and roared, Kai said,
Aye, but you were lucky even so, Arthur. Had that sword struck you a handspan to one side, Guinevere would have even more cause to grieve, and you would be known far and wide as the Gelded King. As in that old legend. Know you not the tale? The king wounded in the thigh, and as his powers fade, so fades the land and withers, till some youth comes who can make it spring fertile anew.
Guinevere shuddered, and Arthur said testily, shifting in pain under the heat of the compress,
This is no tale to tell a wounded man. I should think it would make you more aware of your good fortune, that your land will not wither and be sterile,
Kai said.
By Easter, I dare say, the queen's womb could be quick again, if you are fortunate.
God grant it, Arthur said.
But the woman winced and turned away. Once again she had conceived, and once again all had gone awry, so quickly that she had scarce known she had been with child. Would it be so always with her? Was she barren? Was it the punishment of God on her, that she did not strive early and late to bring her husband to be a better Christian? One of the women took away the cloth and would have replaced it. Arthur reached for Guinevere.
No, let my lady do it. Her hands are gentler, he said.
And Guinevere took the steaming hot cloth. So hot it was, she burned her fingers, but she welcomed the pain as penance. It was her fault, all her fault. He should put her away as baron, and take a wife who could give him a child. It was wrong that he should ever have married her. She had been 18, and already passed her most fruitful years. Perhaps, if only Morgaine were here, I would indeed beseech her for that charm which could make me fruitful. "It seems to me now that we have need of Morgaine's leechcraft," she said. "Arthur's wound goes not as it should, and she is a notable mistress of healing arts, as is the Lady of Avalon herself. Why do we not send to Avalon and beseech one of them to come?" Kai frowned at her and said,
"I don't see that there is need of that. Arthur's wound goes on well enough. I've seen much worse come to full healing.
Still, I would be glad to see my good sister," said Arthur, "or my friend and benefactor, the Lady of the Lake. But from what Morgaine has told me, I do not think I will see them together."
Lancelot said,
"I will send a message to Avalon, and beg my mother to come, if you will have it, Arthur."
But it was at Guinevere he looked, and their eyes met for a moment. In these months of Arthur's illness, it seemed he had been ever at her side, and such a rock of strength to her that she knew not what she would have done without him. In those first days when none believed that Arthur could live, he had watched with her, tireless, his love for Arthur making her ashamed of her thoughts.
"He is Arthur's cousin, even as Gawain. He stands as near to the throne, the son of Igraine's own sister. If aught came to Arthur, then would he be as much a king as we have need of? In the old days the king was naught but the husband of the queen."
"Shall we send, then, for the Lady Vivien?" Guinevere asked.
"Only if you have a wish to see the lady," said Arthur with a sigh. "I think now all I need is a greater share of that patience to which the bishop counselled me when I spoke last with him. God was good to me indeed, that I lay not disabled when the Saxons first came, and if he goes on showing me his grace, I will be able to ride when they come again. Gawain is off gathering the men to the north, is he not, for Lot and Pellinore?"
"Aye,"
Lancelot laughed. "He has told Pellinore that his dragon must wait till we have dealt with the white horse. He must bring all his men and come when we summon him. And Lot will come too, though he grows old. He will not let pass any chance that the kingdom might still go to his sons."
"It will go to his sons indeed, if I give Arthur no son," Guinevere thought. It seemed that every word anyone spoke, of whatever matter, was an arrow, a taunt aimed into her heart for failing the first duty of a queen. Arthur liked her well. They could have been happy. Could she only have felt free for one moment of the guilt of her childlessness? Almost, for a time, she had welcomed this wound, for he couldn't think of lying with any woman, and there was no reproach to her. She could care for him and cosset him, have him to herself as a wife could so seldom do when her husband belonged not to her, but to a kingdom. She could love him, and not think always of her guilt. When he touched her, think of their love, not only of her fear and her desperate hope. "This time will he at last get me with child? And if he does, will it go well with me, or will I cast forth the precious hope of the kingdom?" She had cared for him, nursed him night and day as a mother nurses a sickly child, and when he began to grow strong, she had sat beside him, talked to him, sung to him, though she hadn't Morgaine's sweet voice for singing, gone herself to the kitchens and cooked for him such things as a sick man might be tempted to eat, so that he would put on flesh after the ghastly sickness and wasting away of the early summer. Yet what good is all my care if I do not ensure that there will be an heir to his kingdom?
I would that Kevin were here,
Arthur said.
I would like to hear some music. Or Morgaine. We have no fitting minstrels at court now.
Kevin has gone back to Avalon, Lancelot said. The Merlin told me he had gone for some priestly doings there.
So secret he could tell me no more. I wonder the priests allow these druid mysteries to go on in a Christian land.
Arthur shrugged.
I command no man's conscience, king or no.
Guinevere said sternly, God will be worshipped as he wills, Arthur, not as men choose, and therefore he sent the Christ to us.
But he sent him not to this land, Arthur said. And when the holy Joseph came to Glastonbury and thrust his staff there in the earth and it bloomed, then the druids welcomed him, and he didn't scorn to share their worship.
Bishop Patricius says that is an evil and heretical tale, Guinevere insisted, and the priests who worship in common with the druids should be stripped of their priesthood and driven forth as he drove the druids themselves.
He will not do it during my time, said Arthur firmly. I have sworn my protection to Avalon.
He smiled and stretched out his hand to where the great sword Excalibur hung in its crimson velvet scabbard.
And you have reason to be grateful for that magic, Guinevere. Had I not had this scabbard about me, nothing could have saved me. Even as it was, I came near to bleeding to death, and only its magic staunched the bleeding. Would I not be worse than an ingrate if I betrayed their goodwill?
You believe that? Guinevere asked. You would put magic and sorceries above God's will?
Why, sweetheart,
Arthur said, and touched her fair hair.
Do you believe that anything man can do is in despite of God's will? If this scabbard kept me indeed from bleeding to death, then it couldn't have been God's will that I should die. It seems to me that my faith is closer to God than yours, if you fear that some wizard could undo what God wishes. We are all in God's hands.
Guinevere looked quickly at Lancelot. There was a smile on his face, and it seemed for a moment that he was mocking them. But it passed, and the woman thought it must have been no more than a little shadow.
"Well, if you wish for music, Arthur, Taliesin will come and play for you, I suppose. Though he grows old, and his voice is nothing for singing, his hands still have great skill at harping."
"Call for him, then," said Arthur, and laughed. "In Scripture we are told that the old King Saul called for his young harper to play and ease his mind. But here I am, a young king who has need of his old harper to play and cheer his soul."
Lancelot went in search of the Merlin, and when he came with his harp, they sat for a long time in the hall, listening to the music. Guinevere thought of Morgaine playing there. "Would that she were here, to give me a charm, but not before my lord recovers." And then, looking across the fire at Lancelot, she felt sinking in her body. He sat on a bench, leaning back and listening to the music, his hands tucked behind his head, his long legs stretched out to the fire. The other men and women had gathered close to listen to the music. Elaine, Pellinore's daughter, had been bold enough to come and crowd onto the bench beside Lancelot, but he sat without paying any heed to her. "Lancelot would be the better for a wife. I should bestir myself and write to King Pellinore that he should give Elaine to Lancelot. She is my cousin, and not unlike me.
She is marriageable."
But she knew she would not. She told herself it would be time enough for that on the day Lancelot told them he was seeking to be wedded. If Arthur shouldn't recover. Oh, no, no, never will I think of that. She crossed herself in secret. But, she thought, it was long since she had been in Arthur's arms, and it was likely he couldn't give her a child anyway. She found herself wondering what it would be like to lie with Lancelot. Could he give her the child she wished for? Suppose she took Lancelot as a lover. She knew there were women who did such things. Morgause now made no secret of it. Now that she was past childbearing, her harlotries were as scandalous as Lot's wenching. She felt the colour creeping up in her cheeks, and hoped no one had seen as she looked at Lancelot's hands lying quiet in his lap, and wondered what it would be like to feel them caressing her. No, she dared not think of that. When women took lovers, they must take care not to be made pregnant, not to bear a child who could disgrace them or bring shame on their husbands. So if she was barren then, it wouldn't matter. It would be her good fortune. In God's name, how could she, a chaste and Christian woman, have such evil thoughts? Once before she had thought this, and when she told it in confession, the priest had said only that it was no more than reason that with her husband so long sick, her thoughts should turn to such things. She must not feel guilty, but pray much and care for her husband, and think only that it was harder still for him. And Guinevere had known that this was good and sensible and kindly counsel, but she felt he hadn't understood it in full, just how sinful a woman she was, and how evil and foul her thoughts. Otherwise, surely, he would have berated her and given her heavy penance, and then she would have felt better and more free. Lancelot would never reproach her that she was barren. She became aware that someone had spoken her name, and raised her head in confusion, as if her thoughts were open to all.
"No, no more music, my Lord Merlin," Arthur said. "Look, it grows dark, and my lady is asleep where she sits. She's worn out with nursing me, most likely. Kai, have the men set the dinner, but I will go to my bed and have some meat there."
Guinevere rose, went to Elaine, and asked her to take her place in the hall. She would stay with her lord. Kai went to see to the servants, and Lancelot stayed to give Arthur a hand as he limped, with the help of his stick, to his chamber. Lancelot helped to settle Arthur in bed as tenderly as any nurse.
"If he needs anything in the night, see that you have them call for me. You know where I sleep," he said low to Guinevere. "I can lift him more easily than any other."
"Oh, no, no. I think there will be no need now," she said. "But I thank you." He was so tall as he stood next to her. He laid his hand gently on her cheek.
"If you want to go and sleep among your women, I will stay and watch with him. You look as if you were wanting a long night of unbroken sleep. You are like a nursing mother who has no rest till her babe can sleep through the night without stirring."
"I can care for Arthur. There is no need for you to watch with him now. I can stay in the room within earshot."
"You are so good to me," she said, "but I would rather be near him."
"But send for me if he needs me. Do not try to lift him yourself," Lancelot said. "Promise me, Guinevere."
How sweet her name sounded on his lips. Sweeter than when he said, "My queen," or "My lady." "I promise you, my friend." He bent, gave her just the flicker of a light kiss on her forehead.
"You look so overwearied," he said. "Go you to bed and sleep well."
His hand lingered still a moment on her cheek, and when he took it away, she felt as if her cheek would be cold and ache as if she had a toothache there. She went and laid herself down beside Arthur. For a time, she thought he slept, but at last he said into the darkness,
He has been a good friend to us, has he not, my wife?
No brother could have been kinder.
Kai and I were reared as brothers,
and I love him well.
But it is true what they say. Blood is thicker than water, and blood kin brings a closeness I hadn't imagined till I came to know some of my own blood.
Arthur shifted in bed uneasily, sighing.
Guinevere, there is something I would say to you.
She was frightened, her heart pounding. Had he seen Lancelot kiss her? Would he charge her with unfaithfulness?
He said, "Promise me that you will not weep again. I cannot bear it. I swear it to you. I have no thought of reproaching you. But we've been wedded now for many years, and only twice in that time have you had even the hope of a child. No, no, I beg you, do not cry.
Let me speak," he pleaded.
"It may be that it is not your fault, but mine. I have had other women, as do all men. But though I never made any attempt to conceal who I was, not in all these years has any woman come to me, nor her kinfolk, and said, 'Such and such a woman bore you a bastard child.' It may be that it is I whose seed has no life, so that when you conceive, the child comes not even to quickening."
She lowered her head, letting the curtain of her hair hide her face. Did he reproach himself as well?
"My Guinevere, listen to me. A child there must be for this kingdom. If it should come about at any time that you give a child to the throne, be assured that I will never question. So far as I am concerned, any child you bear, I will acknowledge it mine and bring it up as my heir."
She thought that the burning in her face would make her burst into flame. Could he think her capable of betraying him? "Never, never could I do so, my lord and my king."
"You know the ways of Avalon. No, my wife. Do not interrupt me. Let me speak. Where, when a man and woman come together in this wise, the child is said even to be born of the god. Guinevere, I would like it well if God sent us a child, whoever should work God's will in fathering him. Do you understand me? And if it should so happen that the one who so did the will of heaven were my dearest of friends and the closest of kinsmen to me, then would I bless him and the child you bore. No, no, do not weep. I will say no more," he said, sighing, reaching out his hands to her, letting her lie against his shoulder. "I am not worthy that you should love me so well."
After a time he slept, but Guinevere lay awake, tears rolling down her face. "Oh, no," she thought. "My dear love, my dearest lord, it is I who am not worthy of your love. And now you have all but given me leave that I should betray you." Suddenly, and for the first time in her life, she envied both Arthur and Lancelot. They were men. They lived lives of activity. They must go out into the world and risk death or worse in battle. But men were free of these terrifying decisions. Whatever thing she did, whenever she made any decision, however small, if it was of more weight than kid or dried beef for dinner, then was that weight on her soul, that from what she should decide the fate of kingdoms could rest. Now it was her own choice, and not simply the will of God, that she should give an heir to the kingdom or no. One who was of Uther Pendragon's blood, or otherwise. How could she, a woman, make that decision? Guinevere pulled the fur coverlet over her head and curled herself into a ball and lay there. Only this evening she had sat there and watched Lancelot listening to the harper, and the thought had come stealing into her mind. She had loved him long, but now she began to know it was that she desired him
In her heart she was no better than Morgause, who played the whore when she would, with her husband's knights, and even, the story was whispered, in scandal, with some handsome pages or servant men. Arthur was so good, and she had come to love him well. She had found safety here in Carleon. It wasn't to be borne that the folk about the castle and countryside might come to whisper scandal of her, as they did of Morgause. Guinevere wished to be good, to keep her soul clean and her virtue whole. But also it meant much to her that people should see her virtue and think of her as a good and spotless queen. She herself knew nothing evil of Morgaine, for instance. She had lived at her side for 3 years, and Morgaine was, so far as she knew, as virtuous as herself. Yet it was rumoured that Morgaine was a witch because she had lived in Avalon, and had some wisdom and knowledge of healing herbs and of sendings. And so the people of the court and of the country round about had whispered that Morgaine was in league with the fairy folk or the devil. And even she herself, knowing Morgaine as she did, sometimes wondered how what so many people said could be all untrue. And tomorrow she must face Lancelot, and go about her work by Arthur's side, knowing that he had all but given her leave. How could she ever again look into Lancelot's eyes? He was of the blood of Avalon. He was son to the Lady of the Lake. It could be that he too could read thoughts a little, that he could see into her eyes and know what she was thinking. And then anger, so violent that it frightened her, swept through her trembling body like a flood. Guinevere, lying there, angry and afraid, thought that she would never dare to go out of doors again for fear of what she might choose to do. Every woman in the court wanted Lancelot. Yes, even Morgaine herself. She had seen her sister-in-law looking at him, and for that reason, when, once long ago, Arthur had said they should marry, she had been distressed. Lancelot would surely find Morgaine too bold. And perhaps they had quarrelled, for the last day or two before Morgaine had departed for Avalon, she noted that they spoke less to each other than usual, and didn't turn their eyes to each other. She missed Morgaine, yes. But all in all, she was glad Morgaine wasn't at court, and she would not send to Tintagel to hear news of her if she was there. She fancied herself repeating to Morgaine what Arthur had just said. She would die of shame. And yet she suspected that Morgaine would laugh at her. Morgaine would surely say it was for her to choose whether or no she would take Lancelot as a lover. Or perhaps, even, that it was for Lancelot to say. Then it was as if a burning flame passed through her like the fires of hell that she might offer herself to Lancelot, and he might say to her, no. Then surely she would die of shame. She didn't know how she could ever bear to look at Lancelot again, or at Arthur, or at any of her ladies who had never been so tempted. Even to the priests she would think it shame to speak about this, for they would know Arthur was less a Christian than he ought to be. How could she ever bear to go out of doors again, or to leave the safe, protected space of this very room and this very bed? Here, nothing wrong could come to her, or harm her. She did feel somewhat ill. Tomorrow, she would tell her ladies that, and they would think only, as Lancelot would think, that she was overwearied with nursing Arthur night and day. She would continue to be, as she was always, a good and virtuous queen, and a Christian woman. She could never even think of being anything else. Arthur was distressed from his wound and his long inactivity, that was all. When he was well and sound, he could never think such a thing. And no doubt he would be grateful to her that she hadn't listened to his folly, and had saved them both from a fearful sin. But just as she was about to drop into an exhausted sleep, she remembered something that one of her women had said long ago.
It was a few days before Morgaine left the court. She had said that Morgaine should give her a charm. Well, and so she should. If Morgaine enchanted her so that she had no choice but to love Lancelot, then she would be freed of that fearful choice. When Morgaine returns, she thought, I will speak of it to her. But Morgaine hadn't been at court now for almost 2 years, and it might be that she would never return. Chapter 9
I grow too old for these journeys,
Vivian thought as she rode through the late winter rain, head bowed, her cloak wrapped tight around her body. And then resentment surged through her.
This should now be Morgaine's task. It is she who was to be lady after me in Avalon.
Taliesin had told her 4 years ago now that Morgaine had been in Caerleon for Arthur's wedding, and had been given to Guinevere for one of her ladies, and had tarried there.
The Lady of the Lake, waiting woman to a queen? How dared Morgaine forsake her true and appointed path in this way?
And yet, when she had sent a message to Caerleon with word that Morgaine should return to Avalon, the messenger had returned to say that Morgaine had left the court. They thought for Avalon.
But she is not in Avalon. Nor is she in Tintagel with Igraine, nor yet at the court of Lot in Orkney. Where, then, has she gone?
Some harm could have come to her on one of her solitary journeys. She might have been captured by one of the marauders or masterless men who throng the country. She might have lost her memory, or have been raped, murdered, flung into a ditch somewhere, and her bones never been found.
Oh, no, Vivian thought. If harm had come to her, I would surely have seen it in the mirror. Or with the sight.
Yet she couldn't be certain. The sight was erratic in her now, and often when she sought to see beyond, nothing came but a maddening grey fog before her eyes, the veil of the unknown which she dared not try to pierce. And Morgaine's fate was concealed somewhere within that veil.
Goddess, she prayed as she had done so often before. Mother, I have given you my life. Bring back my child to me while I yet live.
But even as she spoke, she knew that there would be no answer, only grey rain like the veil of the unknown, the answer of the goddess hidden in the unyielding sky.
Had it wearied her so much as this when last she made this journey half a year ago? It seemed now to her that she had always ridden before this, as lightly as a girl. And now the jolting of her donkey seemed to rattle every bone in her thin body, while the cold crept into her and gnawed at her with little icy teeth.
One of her escort turned back and said,
Lady, I can see the farmstead below. We will be there before nightfall, it seems.
Vivian thanked the man, trying not to sound as grateful as she felt. She could not betray weakness before her escort. Garwin met her in the narrow barnyard as she was dismounting from her donkey, steadying her so that she didn't step into the midden.
Welcome, lady, he said. As always, it is my pleasure to see you. My son, Balin, and your son will be here with the morrow. I sent to Caerleon that they might be here. Is it as grave as that, old friend?
Vivian asked.
And Gawain nodded. He said, You will scarcely know her, lady. She has fallen away to nothing now, and if she eats or drinks ever so little, she says it is as if a fire were lighted in her vitals. It cannot be much longer now, for all your medicines.
Vivian nodded and sighed.
I feared as much, she said. When this illness once has a hold on anyone, it never lets loose its claw. Perhaps I can give her some ease. God grant it, said Gawain, for the medicines you left us when you were last here do little now. She wakes and cries in the night like a little child when she thinks of serving women and